Quick announcement, in a few days, I will be in Stockholm, Sweden at the Gather Festival, interviewing live on stage Mark Sargent, the famed flat earther featured in Netflix's documentary Behind the Curve. Now, a few episodes back, we did a show with the producers of that documentary, and we made the show not just about flat earthers, but about conspiratorial thinking, the nature of belief itself, disconfirmation bias, community, tribalism, all sorts of stuff. So I hope to talk about those things on stage with Mark in front of a giant crowd of people with respect, empathy, and goodwill. And I hope that we can all learn more about the nature of truth and how we arrive at our conclusions and all the rest. If you'd like to learn more about this, if you'd like to go, head to gatherfestival.com. And I'm sure audio from this event will be featured in an upcoming episode of the show.
Fall down into the middle of the party, said the dead. Dead is the cool, the happy, they went quiet. Dancing and talking about the power of the gospel. Dead is the cool, the happy, they went quiet.
Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 162. In the 1970s, the field of attitude change and persuasion was, to put it lightly, a mess. Going back to the earliest days of psychology, the study of advertising and marketing, persuasion and propaganda, of influence itself, was a major feature of psychological research. But after World War II, with the whole world asking how it could be that the Nazis rose to power, how people could participate in genocide, influence research became the central focus of psychology.
It was such an important topic that so many people are doing research that that's what sort of led to the collapse.
That is legendary psychologist Richard Petty.
Richard Petty, and I'm a professor of psychology at Ohio State University.
Petty, along with fellow psychologist John Cacioppo, who recently passed away, developed what many consider to be the best model of how humans make sense of and are persuaded by messages that intend to change their minds. It's called the elaboration likelihood model, and they developed it not so much to change the course of psychology, though it did, but to make sense of their own textbooks so they could pass their classes in college.
When you read the textbooks at the time, they really were confusing because you'd get this, well, a credible source in this study did this, but in this study it led to less persuasion, but in this study it had no effect, and in this study it interacted with this other variable. And it was just a series of findings, and it was really hard to, and all you could do to, you know, pass a test would be to try to memorize every individual study and what it found. There wasn't any conceptual coherence that helped you try to pull it all together. And so it was kind of frustrating. And in fact, there's this book called The Annual Review of Psychology, where people every 4 or 5 years try to review the literature in a certain domain. And if you go back to the time, the 70s, early 80s, when we were doing our work, and you read the chapters on attitudes and attitude change, they're pretty depressing. And people would just say things like, man, there's just a jumble of findings here that nobody can kind of understand, you know, when credibility works and doesn't. And in some ways, it's like the replication crisis today. We'd have studies that say, oh, we found this effect, but this study didn't find any effect. Oh my gosh, this study found the opposite effect. And it's like we just, you know, people would throw up their hands. And there's one quote that I didn't look up right now, but we have it in our 1986 book where he introduced the elaboration likelihood model that basically said, you know, maybe we should just put attitude change aside for a while and researchers should study something else because it just doesn't look like there's an accumulating science because there's so many different things.
By the 1970s, psychology had generated an incredible amount of evidence into persuasion, but none of it seemed to fit together into a unified theory because each study seemed to contradict several others. What worked in one context didn't work in another, and what seemed like a persuasive speaker for one kind of message would not be persuasive for a different kind of message.
That everybody was doing studies on attitude change and throwing a finding into the literature that by the 70s, even though, you know, people started studying this scientifically in the 20s, you know, it accelerated during World War II in the 40s and 50s, 60s. The whole field was about attitudes and attitude change for a while, that everybody was doing research, that there were so many findings that it became an embarrassment of riches and an embarrassment in the sense that the studies didn't all agree with each other.
The operating assumption at the time was built on the idea that the effectiveness of a persuasive message hinged on how well the person, the target of the message, learned what that message said. A sociologist and political scientist named Harold Laswell produced a model of communication that said all communications between human beings could be broken down to who says what to whom, in which channel, and to what effect. Who referred to the communicator, says what referred to the message, in which channel referred to the medium or the context, and to whom referred to the audience. With what effect referred to the impact the message had on the audience, and that impact became the focus of psychological research for decades. But with each study, the evidence came with a caveat. For instance, credibility was more persuasive about issues like if the steel industry was to be blamed for the current steel shortage, or should antihistamines be sold without a prescription, or would TV be the end of movie theaters? Remember, this was a while back. But the same speaker who was considered an expert by one group might be considered a quack by another. And if so, the message would be accepted or rejected based on these people's estimation of the speaker's expertise. Yet, oddly enough, weeks later, some of those subjects would report they now considered the same arguments they once rejected to be sound if they had, over time, forgotten where they heard it. Sometimes a single, strong, factually supported, well-produced thesis was more persuasive if presented alongside the opposition's argument. Sometimes, not. Sometimes the order of presentation mattered. Sometimes, it didn't. Sometimes fear made a message more persuasive and sometimes less. Sometimes repetition worked. Sometimes repetition backfired. Well-organized content worked some of the time. Sometimes it caused people to reject the messages altogether. Everything from people's self-esteem to their involvement with the issue seemed to affect the findings of the research. But in another scenario, they affected people in a completely different way. So if you wanted to pass your graduate exams in psychology as a student of attitude change, you had to learn all of this, every study. So to help make sense of it all, Petty and Cacioppo painted one of the rooms of the house they were renting entirely in blackboard paint.
But we did entirely paint one room with blackboard paint so you could write and erase the walls, where we could plot ideas and plot strategy and do all sorts of play games and do all sorts of things. It became impossible to memorize all the different studies and when they did, because again, there was no conceptual coherence, but we outlined, well, maybe they're good under these conditions and maybe they're bad under those conditions, which wouldn't help you pass the test the next day, but it certainly led to us doing some research on that very topic, where you could vary the number of arguments along with the quality, whether the arguments were on a topic that was important or not. And so we, you know, really early on, we're able to outline a number of different things. When I became an assistant professor after graduating grad school, I always felt like I should have taken a photograph of that wall.
As they read hundreds of studies, they began to chalk up summaries on the wall, and slowly, in an effort to pass their tests, they began to group those studies together. What made them similar? And they began to notice a pattern, something every researcher before them had missed. First of all, they found that a message that increased persuasion in one situation almost certainly reduced it in others. In the same way, a tuxedo will improve your looks at a snazzy nightclub, but not so much at a baseball game. Second, they saw that there were two meta-level variables at play among the variables of communicator, context, message, and audience. They were all being influenced by a larger superordinate phenomenon that determined their impact. If you grouped messages by how likely a person was to pause and reflect on its content, all the findings sorted neatly into two categories. A message could produce one of two kinds of thinking, and both could lead to attitude change, but only one of them would become active depending on the conditions present at the time. That insight would lead to the development of what is still psychology's most robust theory of how to change attitudes, the elaboration, likelihood, model.
This is kind of a mouthful. That sounds kind of complicated. And why in the world did they pick those terms? And so the term elaboration was designed to be a contrast in some ways to what the prominent model of attitude change had been before us, and that was a learning model. And a learning model, really, this was Hovland and you know, ever since the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, the idea was, in psychology, cognitive psychology was all about learning. What's the best way to get people to learn, whether it's a list of words or learning text? And so the simplest idea that Hovland had really was that, well, persuasion should be about learning. And it's probably the idea that the average layperson has, right? If you want to change people's attitudes about cigarettes, just teach them what the bad things are. And if they learn them, then they'll change, right? That's all there is to it. If you want people to wear their seatbelts, just teach them, you know, give them the three reasons. And if they learn that's all there is to it. And so literally those early studies would measure, well, how much did you learn what the message said? And it seemed like that should produce the effect. And all the studies were designed to, well, are you more likely to learn the message if a credible source says it or a non-credible source says it? But back then, they never really found that learning had anything to do with how persuaded people were, right? And so the evidence was right there from the get-go that someone could learn the message and not be persuaded. Someone could not learn the message at all and be totally persuaded. So the first idea in elaboration was that it isn't just learning the information. Elaboration refers to you add something of your own to the information. And so that's what the elaboration part is. You're going to add something. And so you could just say it's thinking. But if you think about something and you just ended up learning it or not learning and you don't add anything to it, you know, we thought thinking isn't quite, you know, the right word, but that would be the closest word to it. Are you thinking about the information? And the critical thing about thinking is, do you add something? And so you could get a piece of information, and if you think about it, you might go, well, that's really stupid, right? And so I could learn it, but if I think it's stupid, it's not going to persuade me. If I learn it and I think it's great, I add, someone says, use this laundry soap because it'll make your clothes smell good. It's like, okay, well, make my clothes smell good. Just learning that information alone isn't sufficient to persuade you. You might have to add, oh, if my clothes smell good, then people will hang out with me, right? And so it's that thing you added that makes a difference. And that's what persuaded you, that I added, oh, people will hang out with me. Just because my clothes smelling good could be good or bad. You know, it all depends on what you think about it. That's the elaboration part. And so, and then likelihood is that, okay, well, not everyone's going to be always motivated and able to add something to it. And so you can add something good to it, which would make you more persuaded, or you could add something that's negative. I don't want my clothes. I don't want my clothes to smell like flowers because that'll be embarrassing. And so that's adding something negative to it that makes that argument for you not very good. And so are you likely to elaborate on it? And that's the likelihood part. And so if you're likely to elaborate, then the thoughts that you have about the message, your positive thoughts or negative thoughts, will be what determines whether or not you are persuaded. That's the high elaboration route to persuasion, or what we call the central route, where you're focused on the central merits to you of the information that's presented. Your elaborations are what's determining how influenced you are. But if elaboration is low, and I'm not thinking about the information at all, low elaboration, then my elaborations aren't going to matter, right? Whether I think, because I never thought, because my clothes smell good, people will like to hang out with me. I didn't even have that thought because I'm not elaborating. And so one could have said that when you're not elaborating, there's just no persuasion at all, right? So that would be saying all persuasion only occurs under high elaboration. But one of the things about the elaboration likelihood model was that even if you're not likely to be elaborating because you don't think the issue is important or you're very distracted from engaging in processing or the message, you know, is too complicated for you, you can still be persuaded And that's what the peripheral route is about, that you could be persuaded, even if elaboration is low, if there are simple cues in the environment, like a credible source, or a positive mood, I'm feeling good, or something, or there's a lot of arguments, and so you make the inference that if there's a lot of information, it must be right. Things that could lead you to accept a message or say you agree with it, even if you're not thinking elaboration is low. And so that was the peripheral route. So these peripheral cues would be operating. And so we ended up calling it the elaboration likelihood model, because the likelihood of elaboration is really the driver of the whole thing. If the likelihood of elaboration is high, you're motivated and able to think. You'll be influenced by the thoughts that you have, your elaborations in response to the message. But if the likelihood of elaboration was low, then you would be influenced only to the extent that there were simple cues present in the message that could allow you to accept it without engaging in much elaboration or thinking. And so we called it that, even though it's kind of a mouthful, to try to, one, contrast it with what had come before, learning, that it's not about learning, it's about elaborating, and whether you are or are not elaborating.
When elaboration likelihood is high, people tend to take the central route. But as elaboration likelihood drops off, people tend to move on to the peripheral route. Variables that matter on the central route become meaningless on the peripheral and vice versa. And you can think of this as the central route is a busy street passing straight through the heart of Argument City. On the central route, you have to go slow, pay attention, navigate carefully. You have to think, what are the speaker's main points? Are they logical? Are they cohesive? Are they strong? Do they cite evidence? Is the evidence well vetted? Are the sources trustworthy? On the peripheral route, it's sort of the equivalent of taking a highway bypass around Argument City. You can go fast, and you can still see the city from afar, but at the expense of learning all of its details. The message becomes hazy, and only the most salient and simple cues remain. Is the speaker attractive? Does this message contain a lot of big words? Do they speak eloquently? Do they have a prestigious degree? Are they famous? Will there be pizza at the end of this lecture? Either route can lead to the destination, attitude change, but there's a trade-off. On the central route, you get to see Argument City for what it really is, the good and the bad, the grimy streets, the charming shops, the unique characters, and the mundane office workers. On the peripheral route, you only see Argument City in the abstract, the skyline and the billboards, the famous landmarks and the neon lights. Two factors determine which route one will travel: motivation and ability. Motivation is the willingness and desire to pursue one route over the other, and ability is the cognitive wherewithal to do so. Motivating factors include personal relevance or a high need for cognition, and ability factors include a lack of distraction, personal experience or expertise with the topic, or a clearly communicated, well-articulated message. The more motivated and able one is to process a persuasive message, the more likely that person will remain on the central route.
Motivation is just how much you want to process the message. And so the one that's probably most appealing and obvious to people is you can make the message. If you make the message seem that it's relevant to you, personally important, that will get people to want to process it on their own. But there are other things you can do if you can't make the message personally important. You can provide incentives to do it. You can instill a sense of responsibility. So for example, in some research, we might say, oh, you are the only person who's responsible for assessing this, as opposed to, you're one of 100 people, and we're going to average all your responses. And so you can imagine that if you're one of 100 people, it's a group decision. You will not put as much effort into it as if, oh, my goodness, I'm personally responsible for evaluating this. So you make the message relevant to you, either by saying it's going to affect your life in some way, or you're personally responsible for doing it. If you can't motivate them through one of those two things, another thing that we've tried is sometimes you can put rhetorical questions in the message. And so, you know, you're giving an argument, and you just, in a typical message, you say, and therefore this would be good for students. And then you move on to the next argument, and therefore this would be good for students too. But if you make a slight change and you go da 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 da, wouldn't that be good for students? And you ask the question, it does get people to think a little bit more. So you can motivate them to think by literally posing the question for them in the message that they will think about a little. Like, oh, yeah, that would. And they, if they hadn't been thinking about whether it's good for students, they will then start to think about it and elaborate. So those are all in the domain of trying to motivate people. Ability, sometimes there's natural ability. And so, for example, if a message is kind of complicated, it might require a particular kind of knowledge. And so more knowledgeable people about politics, for example, are able to process the merits of a political argument. But that's something that you bring with you to the situation. Other times, ability is just a matter of the circumstance. So if I have kind of weak arguments, you can distract people from trying to process them. There's the famous story about the attorney Clarence Darrow, who, when he didn't have a particularly strong argument to do, he would get his cigar and he would go in front of the jury and he'd sort of smoke it right there, and it looked like, you know, it was the ash going to fall on the ground, and people were mesmerized by what he was doing there, and they kind of weren't missing, they were missing the substance of the argument. But he would argue that, but they sort of felt like I presented a lot of substances, but he was distracting them from the merits of the argument. So distraction is a way to do it. And sometimes they'll do it with, you know, attractive models in the ad when they have to give you the, or they'll read the disclaimer. You've all heard these on the radio, right, where the disclaimer comes at five times the speed of the regular message. And so, you know, if the message is too fast, you just can't process it. And so, you know, the bad stuff is presented at, you know, three times the speed of the good stuff. And so that's a way of, you know, inhibiting your ability to process a message. But because it's the elaboration likelihood model, the first thing we want to know before we can predict, you know, what effect a variable is going to have is, where are you on that continuum? Are you on the low end, in the middle? Are you on the high end? And so to figure that out, you've kind of got to diagnose the situation of how motivated are people to think about this particular message. And then second, how able are they to think? And if both are high, you know, you're up there on the high end. If both are low, of course, you're on the low end, but you could be somewhere in the middle as well.
And now we take a break from our program for a word from our sponsors. I know you've got something in that head of yours right now, and you want to get it out there into the world. You want to take your dreams and you want to turn them into a reality. You want to put them on the internet for everyone to point at and go, now here's something I wish I'd seen 6 years ago. You can do that with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project. Whether you're looking to start a new business, showcase your work, publish content, sell products, anything, Squarespace is the tool for you. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers and the ability to customize just about anything with a few clicks, you can easily make a beautiful website yourself. Squarespace's powerful e-commerce functionality lets you sell anything online, and analytics help you grow your site in real time. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box, and there's nothing to patch or upgrade ever. And buying domains is just as simple, and you'll get the help you need with Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support. Should you face anything strange, they will tell you how to get through that 24/7. Squarespace empowers millions of people, from designers to lawyers, artists to gamers, even restaurants and gyms. And they can all turn their great ideas into something real. In fact, they have, and now you can too. If you go to squarespace.com/sosmart, where you're going to get a free trial. Squarespace.com/sosmart, you get a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SOSMART to save 10% off of your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/sosmart. And the offer code is SOSMART. If you're going to get into a conversation about something and you want to speak confidently about it, intelligently about it, if you want to have that sense of pride that comes with being able to hold up your end of a discussion so that you and the other person can maybe figure out something together, figure out how it is that you're both maybe wrong about something to get to a higher level, you need something in your life like the Great Courses Plus. I love this service. I talk about it all the time because it's a streaming service that gives you the freedom to learn about virtually anything, and you get unique perspectives from top engaging experts in their fields. So, for instance, among their thousands of lectures, you have topics like the effects of music on your brain, ancient civilizations of North America, improving your productivity, how to survive in the outdoors, how math can be visualized. It's incredible. And with the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen to any of this or anything else from any device. If you love this show, I recommend you check out this one in particular, Your Deceptive Mind, a scientific guide to critical thinking. Discover the science of cognitive biases, critical thinking, how to become a savvier, sharper, critical thinker in your professional and personal life, all taught by Professor Stephen Novella. You get 24 lectures, each one about 30 minutes long, some a little longer. Things like thinking about thinking, the neuroscience of belief, errors of perception, flaws and fabrications of memory, pattern recognition, the structure and purpose of arguments, and logical fallacies and cognitive biases, innumeracy, culture and mass delusions, philosophy and presuppositions of science. I could keep going. It is great. Get that awesome feeling of pride that comes with knowledge by signing up for the Great Courses Plus. And here's the offer. For listeners of this podcast, you can get an all-access trial for free. That's right. You are not so smart listeners can go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart and get all the things I just talked about for free. That is thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. My name is David McRaney, and now we return to our conversation with psychologist Richard Petty about the elaboration likelihood model. My favorite study of Petty and Cacioppo was one in which they told college students about a new policy that would require seniors to pass a comprehensive exam to graduate. They told students, ahead of watching a video presentation of persuasive appeals, that the policy changes were either planned for that year or many years down the line. Right away, some students felt motivated to pay attention, while others were less inclined. The motivated and unmotivated students were further divided into two groups each. One saw either 9 or 3 strong arguments, and the other saw either 9 or 3 weak arguments. The strong arguments included the fact that the most prestigious universities require such exams to ensure their degrees communicate excellence, and students from such universities are more likely to get hired and get higher-paying jobs. The weak arguments said the comprehensive exams harkened back to the traditions of the ancient Greeks, and the fear it produced would probably encourage people to study more. Petty and Cacioppo found that the more motivated the students, the more they took the central route. And on that route, the stronger arguments were more persuasive, and the more of them they saw, the better. On the central route, the weak arguments were ineffective. They saw the flaws in the emotional opinion-based messages and ripped them to pieces. But the crucial thing here was, if you were motivated and you heard 9 arguments, they had to be good ones to persuade you. In fact, if you heard 9 bad arguments, you were less persuaded than if you heard 3 bad arguments. But if you were unmotivated, then you took the peripheral route. And for these people, the strong and weak arguments were equally persuasive. So when they heard more arguments of any kind, even bad ones, they were more persuaded than when they heard fewer. So for them, 9 arguments was highly persuasive, and 3 was not, because they weren't paying attention to the content of the arguments. They were just paying attention to the number.
Yeah, so under the high thinking route, you're going to focus on the merits of the information. And so this was probably the area of research and persuasion about which the least work has been done, right? So that although we know that the merits of the arguments make a big difference when issues are important to people and they have the motivation and ability to think, the question of, well, what is it that makes an argument good and what is it that makes it bad is not very well studied, except for 2 dimensions that everybody would agree on, I think, and these will sound somewhat obvious, probably. And that's that.
I don't know. I'm searching my mind right now, and I'm like, what could they be? But go ahead.
When I say them, you're going to say, oh, yeah. And so an argument is really good if it points to a consequence that is really desirable to you. Right. And so if I said we should raise tuition at your university, and I'm talking to undergraduates, because when we raise tuition, we will hire more professors to have smaller classes, and everyone will learn more and get a great job. And I go, whoa, that is really desirable. That's what I want. So if that, you know, raising tuition is going to lead to all that, I want it. I'll have a positive elaboration to that. And so the consequence you mentioned has to be really desirable, but that's not sufficient. They have to think that desirable consequence is likely to occur. You can think of it even, in gambles. That would be a simpler thing than a persuasive message. Like, should I put my money here? And you'll think, well, how much am I going to win if I put my money here? How much could I win? And the more I could win, the more desirable the outcome, mm-hmm. right? So that's the desirability part. But it isn't just that. You should also factor in how likely I am to win. Because if the likelihood of winning is zero, then it doesn't matter how desirable it is, right? And so if you think about gambles and betting, those are the two. So the expectancy value thing pervades, you know, all sorts of decisions that we make. But in persuasion, you think about the argument that I presented. If I said, if we raise tuition, you will live, you know, a long, healthy life. You'll live to 110 and never have any illness. And people would say, well, that's really desirable. But that doesn't seem at all likely. Right? I don't see how that could possibly happen. So they would denigrate the likelihood, and so it wouldn't be as compelling. So those two are the ones that everyone agrees on. And then it's a current area of research, what other factors you'd throw in. And so some people would say, well, after likelihood and desirability, it'll be more persuasive if it's novel. Right? So if I already thought about the thing that you told me about in the argument, maybe it's desirable and maybe it's likely, but I've already considered it. So it's not going to move me from where I am because the information doesn't have any novelty to me. Right? And then beyond that, there are all sorts of individual differences that different dimensions that people value. So the first three, desirability, likelihood, and novelty, you'd say virtually everybody would consider those. But beyond that, you then have to consider what kind of person you are. Then you start to get into personality. And so some people are very concerned about their image. And so if it makes them look good, that kind of argument would make them persuaded. If you thought about selling a car, right? And so you want good consequences. You want them to be likely. You want them to be novel. But then you'd say, well, what is a good consequence for you? And then here's where we get into individual differences. And so for you, it might be gas mileage, right? That's what makes a consequence because you are concerned about the environment, let's say. But for other people, it might be how much this car will make me look powerful because I'm into the image that the car conveys. And so beyond the first three, you start to get into individual variation. And that's where, you know, social media today, it used to be you could only focus on the first three, likelihood, desirability, and novelty across people. But that's what, you know, the whole Facebook thing is all about these days, that advertisers want to know a lot about you and what you value and what you like in particular, so they can target the arguments and really give you a message that's tailored to be strong for you, even if it wouldn't be strong for me. Because they know you're an environmentalist, and they'll give you cars that, you know, get good gas mileage, and they know someone else is concerned about image, and they'll give them cars with, you know, showing how powerful you'll look.
Well, let's go down the peripheral route for a second then. And what are some things that seem to be, that if you're on that side of the, if you're thinking low, cues that seem to indicate that this is a persuasive message?
Yeah, so here's where you mentioned Laswell before, his famous who says what to whom, you know, under what channel, with what effect. And so you start to think about each of those variables separately. And so you start with who, you know, who says it. And the big three are the credibility of the source, the attractiveness of the source, and how powerful the source is. And so all three of those have the potential to serve as simple cues: credible sources, powerful sources, attractive sources. And under each of those, you can divide, you know, each of those into more specific components. And so you say, well, attractiveness, what does that mean? Well, there's physical attractiveness, there's social attractiveness, there's people who are similar to us are more likable. And so there's really a, you know, a whole long list of things that are associated with the source. So anything, that has a positive value to it can serve as a positive cue. And so you can say anything that makes a person seem likable or desirable or whatever would be something that, if I'm not thinking about what you had to say, could make me go along with you. So that's the source. Then you can move on to the message. And so one of the first things we studied was just how long the message is. And so does the message seem to have a lot of information or not? And if it seems to have a lot, people will say, oh, must be a good idea if there's a lot of information. But anything else about the message that makes it look like it's substantive, right? And so in some research, people would find, if you use big words, even words that people don't understand, it makes it look like, oh, there must be something to this, as opposed to the language is too simplistic. So the complexity of the message could make a difference. But anything that makes a message seem positive can do it. Then there are aspects of the person themselves, right? And so if you're just feeling good in the presence of a message, so I read a message, and when I'm done with the message, I'm feeling pretty good. And you may not realize that you're feeling pretty good because the message was accompanied by a song that you really like, or the message was, you know, literally on very pleasant paper that you read it on. Instead of just black and white, it was all colorful. But you're feeling good after reading the message, and you're not thinking about the message per se. It's reasonable to infer that, well, if I just read this ad for something and I feel good, it must be because I like whatever it is that you said in the message. I like the car that you were advertising or the medication that you were advertising. So there are all sorts of things that you could manipulate about the person, the most prominent of which is, you know, am I feeling good or bad about the message? And so there's the source, the message, the recipient, which we just talked about, feeling good, and then the context in which a message is conveyed. And the context, again, could be pleasant. If I'm reading a message in a dingy, dirty room, again, I'm not feeling really good, and some of that negativity will spill over in the sense of a peripheral cue to make me not like the message, as opposed to the chair is comfortable, you know, everything, the air quality is good, it's just a lovely room, and I'm reading the message, and just, again, those good feelings, in this case from the context, make me like the message. But the bottom line is, under the peripheral route, anything in you, in the source, in the message, in the context, that convey a positive signal of some sort might be sufficient to get me to go along with what you have to say. Because under the peripheral route, it's not about what I'm thinking about what you have to say. It's about one of these things that's extrinsic to what you have to say.
Well, and here's the thing, we'll sort of stop here, but I figure you have a lot to say about it, which is, so we do live in this interesting time where I think if you get on social media and you spend much time on it, there's a good chance you're going to get into an argument. We're also very polarized currently, and there's a lot of opportunity to agree and disagree about what people should or should not be doing. And then you have aspects like of just the natural world that we find ourselves strangely disagreeing about, whether it's whether or not climate change is real, whether or not the earth is flat, whether vaccines do or do not work. And there's just a lot of eagerness for how do we, if we either we think we know the better way or we happen to know the factually correct thing, how do we persuade other people to see things our way? And I'm wondering, since I feel like I'm going right to the mountaintop, and so when it comes to interpersonal persuasion, how can the elaboration likelihood model be applied simply and easily by just, you know, people out there? What are your recommendations?
Well, one of the things that's really changed, I think, about persuasion now in our whole culture compared to when we started this work, you know, many 30-some years ago, is that issues now are so tied to people's identities and groups. And that did not so much used to be the case, right? That people would say, they still had identities, but they weren't as bound up in particular issues and so forth, right? And so one of the things these days that's unfortunate is that people all of a sudden are going to be against something because they think my group doesn't favor, my group thinks, you know, climate change is a hoax. That's what my group thinks. And so if I change my opinion, it isn't just I can listen to you objectively and think about what arguments you have and so forth, or even be persuaded by the fact that scientists say this, and which would be in the old days, just a credible, scientists used to be a credible cue for people who weren't able to think about it. It would have been unthinkable 25 years ago to say, if you said, oh, you know, 99% of scientists think X, you know, and then you had to express your opinion, virtually everybody would go along with that if it was something that they couldn't understand. But now people have a second level of, oh, my group doesn't trust scientists, right? So I can't use that. So the elaboration likelihood model would still say, well, it's Q-based. You still have a Q-based decision, but the Q isn't coming from the credibility of the source, scientists. The Q is, what does my group think, right? And so to sort of break, and that has become so much more dominant. It's become a Q that's, you know, almost all powerful compared to other cues, like credibility and attractiveness and so forth. It's my group. If my group has a position, I have to stay with my group if I'm identified with my group. So, you know, not everybody is super identified with their group, whatever it is. But if you are, and you feel like my group's here, I just can't abandon that because now I'm abandoning my whole group. And so one of the challenges will be, so it's still within the elaboration likelihood model in the sense of, but now we have a cue that we never even considered before, right? You wouldn't find anything in our early work about group identity, right? Because it wasn't a huge thing. And so it's a cue, but wow, is it a powerful cue? And so, you know, the strategies now are there ways to, you know, that people are studying, are there ways to disidentify with this group or to try to see your group as more similar to the other group so it's not as powerful a cue? Or the only way to get the group identity cue not to be there is to, and people try this too, is to make the issue so personally important that I won't rely on the cue of my group identity. That's to say, climate change is going to affect your children. And so do you care about that? And so maybe think, oh, I have to think about this because my children, to try to make it personally important to you that maybe you say, I'll get beyond my group identity cue. But what's interesting about today's environment, I think, is that we've got a new cue. It's group identity. And it's become such a powerful cue that it may be hard. It's hard to work around. But that's where, you know, a lot of interesting contemporary research is looking at.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about an issue like vaccination? Like, how can the elaboration likelihood model be best applied to a situation where, let's say, you're dealing with an anti-vaxxer or just someone who is maybe on the fence and is not sure whether or not they do or do not want to vaccinate their children?
Yeah, so someone who's legitimately on the fence and is ambivalent, and ambivalence is one of those things that typically gets people to think because ambivalence is uncomfortable, and you really want to figure out which side is right or wrong because you don't want to stay in a state of ambivalence because you don't know what to do, right, if you're legitimately ambivalent. So ambivalence is not a bad thing, and sometimes it's good to induce ambivalence in someone who's, let's say, someone's against your view. If you can make them at least ambivalent, they're at least more likely to listen to you because they're trying to resolve the ambivalence. But that's different from someone who's in, the first thing you'd want to know is, why are you an anti-vaccination person? And if it's part of your group identity, I'm part of the, whatever my community is, and we're all anti-vaxxers and whatever, they're not listening to the information because they're just so tied up with their group identity and it's such a threat to abandon it, that you either have to start to weaken the identity itself Right. Well, do you know your group also, you know, if you can find something their group favors that you know they disfavor, you could start to plant some seeds of doubt about whether that identity is the right thing. Right? Because if their decisions are all being driven by this identity, you have to first undermine that identity, make them at least less certain about that identity or more ambivalent about that identity. And then once you can shake that a bit, then they're going to be open to information from people on the other side.
And let's say that they're not groupish. We just follow the basic tenets of the elaboration likelihood model. Then we look for, but there's no reason to modify it for something like this. It's already right there on paper what to do. Is that what you would say?
Yep. If they're, you know, honestly ambivalent, then the same kinds of principles. You want to get them to think about the information, either by motivating them or enabling them. If the arguments are too complicated for them, you have to simplify them. If you need to get people to present the information that are similar to them, so they're more likely to listen to them and adopt the information. And so the central route is typically best because it, you know, leads to longer term change. But in the absence of that, you know, peripheral route change is good in the short term because once they sort of feel like they've moved in your direction, I think your sense is right. So, you know, even if it's getting a bunch of celebrities they favor to show how they vaccinate their children. And so even if they don't understand all the arguments about vaccinations, they go, well, all these people I like and admire are doing it, so maybe I should do it. Then once they sort of move to thinking it's potentially a good idea, then you can present information to bolster it. And once they're on that side, they'll want to hear that information in a way to help justify what position they've taken.
Well, one last question before we head out. When is it good to go on the peripheral route? Like, when is that the better option?
The peripheral routes, you know, sometimes people are just incapable of understanding the argument, right? And they just can't process it, right? And so there are certain domains in which, you know, I'm not going to understand nuclear physics. I'm just not, you know, not that I'm incapable of it, but it would take some time to really understand it. And so if there was, let's say, a particular issue of that was before the country, then, you know, we're going to have to rely on the peripheral route. We're going to have to get experts to make cases and let people rely on that. And then again, as I said before, sometimes once people, you know, some advertisers are perfectly happy with the peripheral route, and that's, let's just take the simplest case where you associate a very well-liked celebrity with your product. The big danger of the peripheral route is it doesn't lead to long-lasting change. But advertisers fix that sometimes by, in the store, having a picture of the celebrity on their product, or, you know, having a display with a statue of the celebrity or a cardboard cutout, you know, pointing to the shelf. And so the peripheral route can, you know, be saved from its flaws by continually reminding people of what the cue is on which people are changing. The benefit of the central route is if I'm really convinced the product is a good one, then you don't have to have the picture of the celebrity on the can anymore because I've already changed my attitude legitimately and I'll carry it with me and I'll act on it. You don't need the picture. You don't need the cues everywhere.
Well, I could talk to you about this for 6 weeks straight, but I feel like we have to stop somewhere and make a show out of it. So I guess the last thing I'd like to know is if people want to keep up with what you're doing, if they want to know how to find you out there, what is the best way to do that?
Best way is probably on the web. I have a website where we try to keep it updated about the latest research that we're doing. And so if they just go to you know, my website, they'll be able to find what current research we're doing, be able to find recent articles that we've published and all that good stuff.
Richard Petty's website is richardpetty.com. That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. For links to everything that we talked about in this episode, go to youarenotsosmart.com. For previous episodes, go to that website, or you can go to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. The opening music, that is Clash by Caravan Palace. The interstitial music in this episode is by Incompetech. You can find their stuff at incompetech.com. You can find the show on Twitter at NotSmartBlog, me at David McCraney. You can also join in on group conversations over at Facebook. It's just /YouAreNotSoSmart. You can also pitch in to help make the show better, to keep it going. It's a one-person operation. Go to patreon.com/YouAreNotSoSmart. Any level of donation gets you the show ad-free, but at the higher levels, you get t-shirts and signed books and all sorts of cool stuff.